Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is the health effects of marijuana. Our guest is Dr. Doris Gunderson. She is the medical director of the Colorado Physician Health Program, and she's actually president of the Federation of State Physician Health Programs. She's also an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Colorado. She's been practicing psychiatry in Denver for over 20 years. She's really been interested recently in following the developments in Colorado after the passage of Amendment 20, which allowed for the medicinal use of marijuana in Colorado, and a later ballot initiative which legalized marijuana for recreational purposes. Dr. Gunderson, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Gunderson, I should mention, is joining us by telephone from Denver. You can reach us with questions or comments about the program today. If you're in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1. You have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. So my review of what I know about you is that you're a forensic psychiatrist, so I'd love for our listeners to hear a little bit about what forensic psychiatrist is so we know a little bit about you, and then if you don't mind at the same time, maybe move into what the Colorado Physician Health Program is all about before we get into marijuana.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm a general adult psychiatrist, so in my private practice, I treat, you know, all a variety of mental health issues, and part-time I do forensic work, and that basically is where medicine meets the law, and I am retained by attorneys and judges to evaluate individuals, to determine if they're competent to stand trial, to determine if there are mitigating circumstances, if they have a mental illness that may have interfered with their judgment, you know, in the course of committing a crime. And in the civil arena, more looking at damages in accidents and other situations where an individual may be harmed.
Okay. All right. And the Physician Health Program, what is that about?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my love. The Physician Health Program is a nonprofit organization that is designed to evaluate physicians with health problems, ensure that they get the treatment they need so they can practice medicine safely. And we also provide ongoing monitoring services to make sure the physician is safe to practice. We do a lot of education to medical students, residents, and practicing physicians about wellness and reducing the incidence of burnout or addiction so that the physician population is healthy and can take care of their patients.
So, in a sense, it's important for everyone to be aware, if they're not already, that physicians have the same issues the rest of the public does, and we try to, through programs like yourself, help physicians that are having problems, often, I guess, related to stress and anxiety and depression and so forth.
Yes, I would say that's particularly true with the evolving and rapidly changing healthcare delivery system. There's a lot of steep learning curves, including for physicians, and it's a challenging time. So just like anyone confronting stress, physicians need help in coping and learning better coping skills.
So periods of change are stressful situations.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. And I think I'm talking to someone who knows that, right?
Well, I understand stress, and I know we're in the middle of some big changes. I understand both of those. You're right. All right, so let's talk about marijuana. Tell us about it in general, a little bit of history maybe. I'm always interested in this issue of maybe it's getting more potent, I've heard. So give us a little bit of background about the product itself.
Well, you know, if you look at the 1970s or even 80s, the THC concentration that people were getting in marijuana was maybe 6% at most, and today the marijuana that's being grown is actually designed to be more potent. They're hybrid plants, and they can increase the potency, you know, two or three times that what was around again in the 70s and 80s. And then through other distillation processes, you can get a THC content or potency of about 80 or 90% in some of the hashish oil that's being developed and infused with butane. It's called BHO. And with those high potency products, you see many more adverse consequences than with low potency marijuana that, you know, was around in the 70s.
So like any potential drug, the concentration or the strength of it is variable, and with that can come different risks of medical effects, it sounds like.
That's right. And, you know, not just marijuana, but, you know, the more potent, say, a narcotic analgesic is, the more likely the individual will become dependent on it and at a quicker pace than something that's low potency.
Okay.
So, you know, it really mirrors what we know about other drugs that have the potential to cause addiction.
Okay. I, in looking up some information about the program, I looked at a recent federal study that showed that the use of alcohol and a lot of illegal drugs in teens, I think the age group was 12 to 17, was actually decreasing. However, with marijuana, it was slightly increasing. So I have to ask, how common is the use of marijuana commonly in the United States? And then your comments on that relative to other drugs.
Sure. I can tell you that in Colorado, we rank third in the nation for adult use, and that's about 42% higher than the national average. And we rank fourth in the nation for youth use. And, you know, what we believe, not just in Colorado, but I think across the nation, people that are interested in this, is when you have any substance that gains increased acceptability, and that comes with legalization, and increased accessibility, you're going to see more people experimenting or using the substance regularly. And I recently read a study that came out of Michigan where 12-year-olds, for the first time ever, were experimenting with marijuana before they ever touched tobacco. This was, I think, in 2009, and that really caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there is some misconception that because something is legal, it's safe. And, you know, we know tobacco is legal, but it's certainly not safe. There's lots of data now to point out harmful effects, if not fatal effects, in some people.
Yeah, that's the way our human mind works, is this perception versus reality. It
fools,
right. It fools us all the time. And yeah,
right.
Okay.
But I do think, you know, it's fair to say that there's increased use in states where legalization has occurred.
Okay. How many states now have legal use, either recreational or medicinal, for medicinal purposes?
Boy, I can't, you know, it's maybe six or eight. I know Washington State and Colorado are the two states that have fully legalized marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And other states, I think it's just medicinal. And that really has been the introduction. It's a little bit of a Trojan horse, if you will, that the marijuana is first medicalized, and in most states it's introduced for a part of the population we all feel a lot of compassion for, people who have illnesses that are refractory to conventional treatments. But very quickly, the second part of the campaign occurs, which is to legalize it for recreational purposes as well.
Can you, as best you can and simply as possible, describe the current Colorado laws for both medicinal use, and
mm-hmm.
Recreational use?
Okay. Well, with medicinal use, a patient with one of the qualifying conditions, there's about six or seven qualifying conditions, such as severe pain, spasticity, HIV/AIDS, severe nausea, seizures, and I'm blanking on a couple of others, but if they have been diagnosed with those qualifying conditions, they can meet with a physician who evaluates them and writes a recommendation. It's not really a prescription. We can't do that because marijuana currently is a Schedule I drug, which basically is by the DEA's view, has no healthy purpose. So they can meet with a physician if the physician concurs with the diagnosis and believes they may be helped by using marijuana. They will write a recommendation, and then the recommendation is reviewed at the public health department level, and the patient is issued a card to have access to marijuana for 1 year. The licensure occurs for 1 year. And there, you know, there are restrictions now. When Amendment 20 first passed, there was really no limit on the number of caregivers or a number of the plants grown or kind of physician behavior. There was a Senate bill that passed after Amendment 20, which made sure that physicians who were engaged in this practice didn't get kickbacks from dispensaries or growers. The Senate bill also made sure that there was a bona fide relationship, meaning the physician had to see the patient in follow-up, keep a chart, consult with other physicians the patient was seeing. There was a limit on the number of plants that could be grown, and, you know, just tightened up the original law quite a bit. With recreational marijuana, you know, any adult can go to a dispensary and purchase marijuana. I'm sorry, I don't know the exact amount that they can carry legally. It cannot be consumed in public places, although that is happening, you know, at concerts and different festivals. I mean, I think it's very hard for law enforcement to be able to enforce that law. But that is the law, that it shouldn't be consumed in public places. In Colorado, we've adopted a 5 nanogram per milliliter cutoff for driving. And that was very controversial for a variety of reasons, but that was adopted. And I believe in the court, a driver can contest the charge. So it's a little bit different than a DUI. And obviously with a DUI, we have better scientific information to correlate impairment with a breathalyzer test.
Mm-hmm. What about the control of the product itself, the mm-hmm. amount of active agent? I'm thinking of is how variable that product might be, how much it may be cut with other products. What is there regulations involved in the control of those kinds of issues?
Not really. You know, and I think that is something for the public to think about, that, you know, these plants are grown with certain pesticides and herbicides, and there may be mold in the products, things like that, that really aren't regulated at this point. Mm-hmm. There is more regulation coming forward with edibles. There were 2 deaths in Colorado related to edibles, and so the packaging is going to be different, and the instructions or the consumer information more precise, so that you know, people know how to use it more safely. The issue was that with one of the individuals who died, he had a cookie edible, and the instructions basically said only consume 1/6 of this cookie, but he ate the whole thing like most of us would do, I think, and he became very agitated and psychotic and actually jumped off a balcony. Yeah. So that, you know, you'd think that edibles might be safer because you're not smoking a substance, but right. in fact, that turned out not to be true, at least in Colorado.
Let me take just a second to remind listeners you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is the health effects of marijuana. My guest is Dr. Doris Gunderson. Dr. Gunderson is a medical director of the Colorado Physician Health Program. She's a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Colorado. And has really been following the Colorado experience after legalization of marijuana for both medicinal and recreational purposes. If you've got questions or comments during the program today, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1 at alaskapublic.org and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. If you go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and find the Line 1 link there to this program, which should be fairly easy to do, there's also a couple of links that are important that you might want to use as resources. There's a link to a report called The Legalization of Marijuana in Colorado, The Impact. It was Volume 2. It's the August 2014 report, which has looked at a large number of facts related to changes in health issues in Colorado. And then another article that is linked is The Adverse Effects of Marijuana Use from the New England Journal of Medicine, dated June 5th, 2014. Dr. Gunderson, since I just mentioned that last article, can we talk just briefly about known medical effect or health effects, let's say, of marijuana? And I know this is sometimes an area where there's some discussion. There's often in science, there's a lot of disagreement necessarily, but the best information we know, as you see it anyway, about what we know about the medical or health effects.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously we know that any smoked substance is not good. And there is debate about whether or not marijuana is a carcinogen. Certainly there are, you know, products that it's developed with that can increase the risk for cancer. So, and if not cancer, you know, it is an irritant to the lungs, so at least bronchitis or other kind of inflammation to the lungs. You know, I think that a lot of focus has been on children and adolescents because the adolescent brain is not fully developed, and marijuana use can, in fact, impact the hippocampus, and this is a part of the brain that is involved in short-term memory and new learning. And so the use of marijuana can actually cause that part of the brain to function less strongly and actually atrophy to some extent. And so there's, I think, legitimate concern that you have an adolescent or early college student using marijuana regularly and what that does to their development, you know, their ability to learn material and also just mature from kind of a psychosocial perspective. We know that, particularly with the more potent marijuana, I think it was between 1998 and 2008, the potency of seized marijuana in this country increased by 103%. And as I mentioned before, with that kind of potency, you will see more addiction. And it is true that marijuana tends to have a lower risk for dependence than things like cocaine or, you know, other potent substances. But individuals can get addicted to it. And I think the number now is between 9 and 10% of those users will develop a dependence diagnosis. There are a lot of psychiatric risks associated with using marijuana. We see, certainly in Colorado, but I think other places, more emergency room visits for severe anxiety, psychosis. Some hospitalists are seeing what's called a cyclic vomiting syndrome, and young adults are coming in with this intractable vomiting, and it's related to using potent marijuana on a daily basis, and the only way to really treat that is to eliminate the marijuana. There are certainly cognitive effects, even at low levels in the serum. There's been lots of studies looking at neurocognitive tests of memory, attention, concentration, executive functioning, you know, meaning problem solving, that are, you know, acutely impaired by short-term use of marijuana and especially impaired by long-term chronic use of marijuana. And, you know, very concerning, there has been some research looking at actually measuring reduced IQ points. I think it's between 6 and 8 IQ points with chronic heavy users. And, again, this is a younger population that we're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from the health effects, you know, I like to think of the public's health as well. And certainly with a substance, you know, that can impair cognition, you worry about those individuals in safety-sensitive employment, operating machinery, or physicians for that matter. what that could do to jeopardize the safety of the public at large.
All right. I have a couple of questions about that, but we have had a couple of callers come in. I want to take a couple of calls, and we'll maybe come back to these issues. So, Tom, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to talk about the mental health issues, and then she brought up some interesting things. So, as a teenager, I tried it, and so when people offered me cocaine and crack and all meth and all these things, it was easy for me to say no. Because I understood that there were bad effects with that, and I was more than content with with the marijuana. Some of the psychological effects of marijuana is when you're arrested and they put you in prison. Wonderful person, your son, a good boy, innocent people that have smoked or spend a lot of time in prison. And the mental health disaster that brings, and I think it's your business, it's your choice, and people that abuse all substances, and so not to pick out on just the one, because if they're abusing that, the others, and if you have it like a coffee or a tea, you got energy to clean the house and get everything done that you need to do. And that's my take on it.
All right, Tom, thanks for your call.
Tom, yep. I'd have to agree with the caller that it's very tragic in this country that many people were given prison sentences for being in possession of marijuana when the laws were a lot stricter. And fortunately, there is a trend toward decriminalizing. And I also agree with him that not all people become addicted to this substance, but I think we have to be mindful of what I talked about before, that with increased access, increased acceptability, we're seeing younger people use this substance. And again, there is debate about whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that the addiction specialists I know feel very strongly that it is, and you know, there's been research looking at this. But other people say no, you know, that it's less addictive and it doesn't lead to using, you know, more drugs or other substances that can be harmful. So there's debate there, but I do think we need to be thinking about the broader issue: is what kind of message are we sending to younger people when we make the access to a substance like this easier?
Okay, Tom, thanks for your call. One of the things that got my attention, I mean, certainly this issue of gateway drugs and dependency is multifactorial. It's very difficult to study. What's the underlying reasons that people may use it? That's a confounding variable. And then there's this other issue that you brought up, is that the potency is increased. And as the potency increased, it appears, at least from what I heard you say, and makes some sense, that the likelihood of dependency would increase as well. So that begs the question as to why has the potency increased?
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of like the food industry, bigger is better.
Right.
You know, we see supersized ice cream sundaes and hamburgers and, you know, soda drinks. And so, you know, I think that's kind of the culture here, that we're always improving on something. and I think the science has really lend itself to this industry, you know, way, you know, more information, more knowledge about how to grow more potent plants.
Right.
And to be fair, you know, the science has also helped growers minimize the amount of THC in a plant so that it is more cannabidiol, which, you know, we're finding may be very useful for some intractable seizures in children. I think there needs to be a lot of science, but being able to make hybrid plants can be a good thing, too, if we really dial down at a granular level and study the individual components of the plant. I think that's what's missing right now. You know, the cannabis plant has more than 400 different substances, and to study it as a plant is like crushing 100 antidepressants together, putting the product in a capsule and seeing what it does. So I really think the research is sorely needed, and, you know, I'm hoping that will happen. In Colorado, part of legalizing marijuana was also putting funds toward research, and a scientific advisory committee has recently come together to begin vetting requests for abstracts, and some research will be on the way, although hampered by the fact that it's a Schedule I drug. The types of studies that will be able to take place are limited.
All right. Jana, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, could you address the effects of marijuana use during pregnancy on the baby and afterwards during breastfeeding?
All right, so the effects of marijuana on and during pregnancy, the effects on the baby and during pregnancy, do you want to talk about it? Is it being used, you're just talking about recreational or being used for, let's say, morning sickness or just in general?
Just in general, mothers using it.
Okay.
Okay. You know, what we know is that women using marijuana while they're pregnant, it's not that much different than using tobacco when they're pregnant, that there's a risk for small for gestational age infants, meaning they're born at a smaller weight than you would predict or that's healthy. And THC does cross the placenta, so the fetal brain is being exposed to that. And, you know, I don't know that we've done a lot of research on fetal cases, but if you look at what we know about children and adolescents, I'd be worried about that exposure. And then it is, THC is also very lipophilic, meaning that it likes to be in fatty substance. So it crosses the blood-brain barrier very quickly, too, and it is passed in breast milk to the infant. So I think it's probably, you know, until we have more information about this, probably a good idea to abstain during pregnancy and while nursing an infant.
I think it'd be reasonable to reemphasize the fact that we don't know all that's in these products while you're taking them as well. There's
right.
the control of the quantity of product as well as what other substances make it a little bit more difficult to predict side effects or especially unforeseen consequences from it. So it's the other thing I, as a pediatrician, I have to say is that we're really increasingly aware that these first 1,000 days from the birth or from conception till 2 or 3 years of age is extremely important in the neurologic development, in the psychosocial development, emotional development of children. So these are times when it's particularly we need to be careful, and the consequences can be lifelong as well,
right.
More importantly. So it takes a little bit of extra need for concern of any products during this period of time. Jana, any other questions regarding that?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you for calling.
Yep, great question. Fran, you're on line one.
Yeah, you know, being of the generation of the 60s and 70s, I was wondering if any studies were done on the cognitive effects of the adults who have used it daily since the 60s and 70s. Do they have an increased
right.
risk of Alzheimer's,
right.
of dementia, things along that line?
Okay.
That's a great question, and I think any researchers looking at the increased incidence of Alzheimer's should consider things like that. We don't know if there's a specific link to Alzheimer's, but we do know with chronic use there are chronic cognitive problems, and those problems can range from poor short-term memory, poor attention and concentration, difficulty problem-solving, slowed reaction time. Some develop what we call an amotivational syndrome, where there's just this inertia and not a lot of excitement about getting things done or being productive. So I would say that heavy chronic users are probably not at the top of their game.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Before we take a break, which we'll do just shortly, I was again grabbed a bunch of articles, and there has been at least one report looking at Swedish men finding those who smoke marijuana at age 18 especially the heaviest users, were more likely to end up on the Swedish nation's disability rolls by age 59. There's a number of reasons, again, that can be confounding variables in this, but there were including psychosis and other issues. So the long-term use, at least in that one study, was associated, not cause and effect necessarily, with some long-term problems in general. Well, it's been a fast 30 minutes. We've got to take our break here, and then we'll come right back. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be gone for just about a minute, and then we'll continue our discussion on health effects of marijuana and the Colorado experience with its legalization for recreational and medicinal purposes with Dr. Doris Gunderson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our discussion today is regarding the Colorado experience with the legalization of marijuana for both medicinal and recreational use. Our guest is Colorado psychiatrist, Dr. Doris Gunderson. You can email any questions over the next 25 minutes or so to line1@alaskapublic.org. Call us locally at 550-8433. Are toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. On our website, alaskapublic.org, you can find a link to the Line 1 program and a couple of reference articles dealing with the Colorado experience and what's known about medical effects. And if you're listening between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, that's a rebroadcast. We will not be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Gunderson, let's now just move ahead into what we know about the Colorado experience. You've been an observer of this. Tell us the important health impacts that seems to have flowed from the legalization of marijuana for both of these purposes.
Okay. Well, there is an organization called the Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, and they have, from the legalization of marijuana up until, I believe it was August 2014 that they put their report out, tracked some of the consequences or observations made in Colorado. And, you know, I mentioned that the adult use in Colorado is 42% higher than the national average, but we've also seen some worrisome trends in that traffic fatalities involving marijuana have increased 100% just between the years of 2007 and 2012. And what is relevant about that is that traffic fatalities in general in Colorado related to impaired driving have trended downward. So that's an important and worrisome observation. We've seen, you know, possibly more drug-related crime. In 2013, about half of adults arrested in Denver City tested positive for marijuana. In terms of health effects, we've seen many more hospitalizations related to adverse reactions to marijuana. Just between 2011 and 2013, those hospitalizations increased by 82%. And similarly, for emergency room visits, increased by almost 60% between that same time period. Very worrisome is that between 2006 and 2013, child exposures to marijuana increased by 268%. Very concerned about that. And again, we think this is more related to edibles and a child not knowing, you know, that contains a psychoactive substance. We were used to some of the meth labs exploding, but now we have labs exploding that are making this BHO product. It's a type of hash oil infused with butane. So there have been some lab explosions in the city, but also in cars and at homes with butane tanks explosions and some fairly serious injuries sustained. Just in 2014 alone, there were 27 people injured in these accidents. And what is also concerning to me is that in the last 4 or 5 years, the highway interdiction seizures have increased by about 400%. And what that means is that Colorado really is an export state. There's a huge black market. And so, you know, we've legalized it in the state, but it's been very difficult, I think, to enforce the law. And, you know, we'll see how that trend plays out. What's worrisome for the state, I mean, the belief was that by legalizing marijuana, there would be a projected annual revenue up to $100 million. And the actual revenue realized has been more like $12 to $30 million. And when you look at the expectation that about $100 million would be needed for all the things that go along with regulating marijuana, creating increased law enforcement, more public health regulation oversight, the research I mentioned, and also some funding going to substance use disorder treatment centers, were far below the projected need in revenue to make all of that happen. So that I think that's a real concern for the government in our state, too, that this may not be a moneymaker as projected, but, you know, maybe something that's very costly mm-hmm. to citizens living here.
What about youth use? I started the program by commenting that it looks like there's pretty good evidence that illicit or illegal use of drugs by teens was on the wane. A little bit of a blip nationally, it looked like, on the upward sense with marijuana. What's been the Colorado experience?
Well, again, you know, we rank fourth in the nation for use of marijuana in children and adolescents. And in this same report I alluded to, there are statistics on the number of kids being expelled or suspended from school related to possession of marijuana on campus. Some kids are, you know, able to obtain marijuana from adults and then sell it in schools. There's been some unintended exposures to students as well as teachers. And as I mentioned, you know, more emergency room visits and hospitalizations for both acute adverse side effects, but also for treatment of dependents.
Okay. Let me take another caller or two here. Deborah, you're on line one.
I am. Thank you, Dr. Woodard, and thank you, Dr. Gunderson. I have a Colorado-specific question and then a more general question relating to something we care a lot about in Alaska. The Colorado-specific question is, it's my understanding that alcohol use rates have, in fact, not decreased in Colorado since legalization, but, in fact, have increase. But, you know, I think a lot of people are suggesting that if you legalize marijuana, alcohol rates will go down. But my understanding is there's no evidence of that in Colorado or anywhere else, and would love to know if that is your understanding, too. And the second thing is Alaskans care a lot about flying airplanes. A lot of Alaskans are pilots, and we fly a lot. And I understand there's a very interesting study out there involving marijuana use in pilots. So I wondered if you could share that with the listenership.
Absolutely. The first question about alcohol, in fact, there is no reduction in alcohol sales or consumption in Colorado. So that anticipated outcome didn't happen. And there are two studies on pilots that I'm aware of, and both of them very interesting. One was done in Australia, and one was done in the United States. And this was, the one in the United States was done in the mid-'80s. So this was a time with much lower potency marijuana. And what they did was take a number of very seasoned pilots and have them take a flight simulating test. And then they each smoked a marijuana cigarette with precisely the same amount of THC in each cigarette. And then 24 hours later, the pilots re-performed on this flight simulation test. And all of them, their performance was impaired. They're trending toward impairment. And what was more concerning about that to me is that the pilots were unaware that they were impaired. You know, sometimes you might know that you've had a little too much to drink and you take a cab home or you, you know, eat a dessert and wait a little longer in the restaurant before you leave. But if you don't know you're impaired, that's a very dangerous situation, especially, again, in safety-sensitive types of employment like flying an airplane.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
Sure.
Is that also fair to say that you don't know you're necessarily impaired or as much with other medic drugs? I'm thinking alcohol or even antihistamines for that matter.
Sure. And to be fair, you know, we have a variety of medications that have been approved by the FDA that have cognitive impact too. And you know, one we're struggling with in Colorado are opioids, that they're overprescribed, and we're trying to rein back on that and keep the public safe.
Right. All right. BJ, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm a 54-year-old Alaskan who lost her job 2 years ago because of a mast cell disease and the effects that it has on me and the medications I was taking to control the symptoms. I have begun having a lot of issues with pain, and I can't take opioids. I can't take most of the medications.
Right.
Can't take NSAIDs, anything like that. I am a legal user of marijuana in the state, but of course there's no way to purchase it here.
Right.
And I also have a tragically bad brown thumb. That is, it's very frustrating. And I'm glad to see that other states are beginning to legalize at least medical marijuana outlets. I'm curious, you said that there are now some studies that are being lined up. Can you talk a little bit more about those studies? I know that there's been a dearth of them in this country. But thank
sure.
you. Thank
you. Absolutely, and I'm sorry for your pain and suffering. And, you know, I think in Colorado when we passed Amendment 20, an amendment to our Constitution for medicinal uses, we were thinking of people like you that, you know, were not responding to conventional treatments and were suffering. There are some studies in the literature that they're small, you know, that might be 25 participants in the study, or I think one had 50 participants in a study, that really did show that marijuana or marijuana products may be helpful in treating neuropathic pain, which, by the way, is one of the most difficult types of pain to treat. So that was promising. The problem with the studies that have been done thus far is that they can't be designed like we would for a new drug, where they're randomized, they're double-blind, they're placebo-controlled, and, you know, which are the gold standard studies that really will tell you just how safe a new drug is and how efficacious it is, how well it works. And mostly the studies are, again, small and kind of retrospective in nature, which isn't the best design. In the studies that we'll be able to do in Colorado won't be those kind of studies either. I think what I would like to see happen for the purposes of research is that researchers who design good studies to answer these questions would get past the Schedule One ranking of marijuana right now, which prohibits those studies from being done. That needs to happen, and I think for researchers first, rather than all physicians. So, you know, again, there is some evidence that it can be helpful for pain. We just don't have the kind of evidence we would for something that is approved through the Food and Drug Administration.
I see. Why exactly can these double-blind studies not be performed? Am I being thick about this, or am I?
No.
I'm just not understanding.
Well, the studies that can be done are more observational studies and using rating scales for someone that's used marijuana, but as long as it's a Schedule One drug and it remains illegal in the federal government eyes, those studies can't be conducted. So it's a real barrier, and you know, I would like to see the National Institute of Health or other federal entities have relaxed laws so they can study, and we have good information for the public that we can offer something that we know is safe because the right kind of studies have been conducted.
I see. Thank you very much for that information.
Yep.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for your call. All right, Bud, you're on line one.
Hey, I have a couple questions. Hey, so in that driving test you mentioned, or not driving test, you said traffic fatalities and incidents have gone up since Colorado's legalization. I just wanted to clarify the testing method. Is that the method that shows in the last 6 weeks someone has been on marijuana, or is it within just a couple hours, like during the accident?
They looked at anyone who tested positive in a urine drug screen test. So that's, you know, that's a little harder to determine the timeline.
So
but certainly, you would think that someone that has used marijuana acutely and are driving would be more at risk for an accident than someone that, you know, uses chronically and maybe has a little more tolerance, although I mentioned the cognitive impairment as well would play in.
But I understand this. If you were to smoke every night and during the day you would drive and get an accident, you would still, by your analysis, would be culpable for, you know, being high while you got into a car accident. Is that correct?
Well, no, the urine analysis is really more of a binary test. You've either been exposed to it or not. It doesn't, the quantity of the THC metabolite isn't really going to help you all that much, because it could be high with a novel user, or it could be high, you know, with a chronic user. What would be more helpful is if serum tests were taken, blood tests were taken, because then you know exactly how much was in the bloodstream at the time or shortly after an accident, and that's much more useful in determining whether or not that person was impaired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just wanted to clarify that it doesn't really mean that they're, you know, on marijuana at the time of the incident. Just
right.
It's in the
right.
System.
Okay. Yeah, so that's one of the confounding variables. But I don't remember the data. I looked at this report as well. Is it true that the number of fatalities or the number of traffic arrests and so forth related for driving problems, just the presence of marijuana was higher now than it was before the legalization, or is that not true? I mean, suggesting that, you know, there clearly has been a change related to the use of marijuana.
Right. Right. What I can say is the traffic fatalities where marijuana has been involved, meaning marijuana was detected in the driver, have increased 100% in the last few years.
Okay. So just the presence of marijuana has been increased in fatalities.
Right.
Okay.
And again, where fatalities related to alcohol impaired driving have actually trended downward. Mm-hmm. And that may be more related to law enforcement really getting stricter about people who are cited for driving under the influence, and there are fairly significant penalties, including revocation of licensure. So it could be that the stronger enforcement is making people think twice about driving after they've consumed alcohol.
We're in our last 10 minutes, and I kind of want to maybe get a little bit philosophical and ask your opinion as a physician, a psychiatrist who's been involved in this, a little bit of a more how do we address these issues question. So what I wrote down here to ask is, how do we as a society address the use of drugs like alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana? Throwing a lot of things in the same basket, I understand. How do we balance these individual freedoms versus public health needs and public health expectations? How do we do that? I want to also point out that we've had some great success with public health initiatives in promoting automobile safety and avoiding tobacco effects. So clearly we can, through some educational campaigns, which are pretty expensive, make some changes in dangerous activities.
Well, I think you've asked the million-dollar question for today. you know, I think it's going to be a variety of initiatives, and for me personally and professionally, I would like to see us first protect children and adolescents, because we know there are negative health effects. And, you know, if you've ever been around an adolescent, you know that they have this omnipotence about them, and nothing bad's going to happen to me. They're impulsive, so we really need to try to protect that population to the extent possible. And that's a lot of education, not just to the children directly, but their parents and schools and so on. And I do think, as a psychiatrist, I think we need to educate people that if they have some type of genetic vulnerability, there are mental illnesses in their family members, that they in particular, you know, would be at higher risk, just like with alcohol. If there is a family history of alcoholism, you want to be very careful about, you know, one, are you going to drink at all, or two, if you do, what kind of parameters would help you not get to that place of dependence. You know, I'm very, very enthusiastic about research. If there are medicinal properties for this substance, let's find them. You know, we developed aspirin from a willow bark, and so maybe this plant has good medicinal purposes as well. And I'd say, you know, since the dawn of time, people have used psychoactive substances, always been there. If you read any literature, including the Bible, people tend to experiment with these substances, either simply to get high or as part of, you know, some type of ceremony or religious experience. And I just think we really need to educate people about, if you're going to use these substances, present it in more of a harm reduction model, you know, to use moderately. Don't drive. Don't operate machinery. Don't let your children have exposure to these substances that they shouldn't have exposure to. And finally, I'd say, you know, we are going to see more addiction with marijuana being legalized, that we need to destigmatize treatment for substance use disorders. That population of patients that I see in my practice are really more stigmatized than any other patient with a different disease. And we need to make them understand that when they do become dependent on a substance, it's a real disease. The brain has been hijacked. The brain is rewired in a way that's not healthy, and that they need and deserve treatment.
Are we able yet, I mean, do we have enough information to compare the fairly early Colorado experience on health effects with that of other states? And I suspect the answer may be we don't have enough information. But what about other countries? Are you aware of, have other entities had similar or different experiences?
You know, I'm probably not the person to answer that question. I honestly don't know.
Okay. All right. Should, in your opinion, marijuana be a Schedule I drug?
I would like, again, you know, in a limited capacity, for the DEA to allow researchers to study marijuana and its components in a way that we normally would conduct studies, right, for medicinal purposes. Right. And in the process, we may learn more about, mm-hmm, adverse effects as well. You know, what profile of a person is more likely to get addicted or more likely to become psychotic or more likely to have severe cognitive impairment. So, yes, I think it should be on Schedule I until we have definitive information about its safety and usefulness in medicine. But I would like a select body of researchers to have access and to be able to use it without jeopardizing, you know, themselves legally.
Another editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine brought up another kind of interesting point of view on all of this, and that is trying to compare the rise in tobacco use after the Second World War could suggest what might happen with the use of marijuana, in that the marketing of that product really changed the public's perception of the safety or appropriateness of use of the product, which eventually turned out to be quite dangerous after,
right,
it took quite a bit of time to change the public's understanding of that. And so that, in addition, it makes me think about a book I'm in the middle of reading called Merchants of Doubt, which really is going through all the misuse of science by scientists to substantiate the hazards of tobacco, acid rain, the ozone, global warming, and so forth. So people have to be very careful about how they interpret what they're reading. Comments?
That's very true, and I think you're right. We've seen that with the tobacco industry, that scientists employed by the industry failed to disclose information that may have allowed us to warn the public much sooner than we did about the capacity for addiction and health hazards. And, you know, it's interesting, as I watched the marijuana industry grow in Colorado, the way it's being marketed is it's organic, and in terms of wellness and medicine. And again, I think it gives the public the perception that it's a benign substance, and it may be for some people in some forms and potency, but there is a darker side that I think we need to educate the public about as well.
If I was going to sell somebody something, I wouldn't give them the whole story.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we're in our last couple of minutes. What do we want to remember or have you summarize from the Colorado experience as we come to grapple with this issue in November, when we're going to vote on a similar possible legislation?
Well, I'd say, you know, remember, it remains a social experiment and an economic experiment and a health experiment. You know, we just don't know enough, and I think it'll take a couple of decades to really look back and see whether this was a good idea or not. What I would suggest, and it may not be very popular for those proponents of legalizing marijuana, is you wait and let Colorado be the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And just, you know, we're
the precautionary,
you know, on the national
principle,
news,
yeah.
And trying to figure this out as we go along, and it's embarrassing sometimes, and at other times we kind of get the regulations and the mastery right. But I really would encourage all states who have not legalized marijuana to wait and let Colorado, let Washington figure all of this out before you unroll it. And I guess the other thing I'd say is, it could be very appealing from an economic standpoint, the projected revenue, but it's not happening. So, you know, I would caution states to be very careful that if you think there's going to be this huge revenue from this industry, it's not the government necessarily that's going to bank on it. It's in fact, more the black market, I'd have to say.
Thanks so very much for taking the time to be with us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed the conversation, and, right, you know, stay tuned, I guess.
All right. Thanks for your time again. My thanks to today's guest, Colorado psychiatrist Dr. Doris Gunderson. If you'd like to continue the conversation on the health effects of marijuana, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to talk about something different. There's a controversy, as you're probably aware if you listen to this program, regarding breast and prostate cancer screening. And the question is the same thing true of colon cancer screening? On our next program, we'll discuss the symptoms, the screening tests that are available, and the treatment of colon cancer with Anchorage gastroenterologist Dr. Sakit Ambosh. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, October 13th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and also audio engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.